Welcome to Romancing the Saints with Pastor Gene Pensiero. We're glad you're joining us as we study verse by verse through books of the Bible, discovering God's extravagant love for His people. Now we pick back up in our verse by verse study through the book of Deuteronomy.
We're trying to get through chapters 21 through 23, but don't sweat it. We'll be out at the regular time. If I had to title this message, I would call it Court is Now in Session. Lots of odd things happen when people live together in a society. That's why we like some of those reality shows where people have to form new societies. I have to admit, I watch Survivor. Anybody a Survivor fan? Anybody watch Survivor? How can people get so emotional in 39 days? If you've ever watched it, I mean, they act like it's real life. You lied to me. It's a game. It's I'm playing for $1 million. It's not like we're in the Donner Pass eating each other. I mean, you know, I think it would be different. It'd be different in real life, you know? I mean, you know, you're like having these conversations. There's a guy 3 feet away with a television camera, you know, and stuff. It's crazy. But in regular, even, but I like it because I like the social behavior that people get into. And they do form little groups and you see some things. Or there's, I've never seen it, but there's one about, what's the one about the house where they all live in the house? What's the name of that? Big Brother? No, Big Brother, no, yeah. Anyway, and people do all these weird things when they're living together in a society. Laws are made to promote the public welfare. The next three chapters cover various laws in no particular order that I can ascertain. They are sort of like the cases that a judge might get one after the other, dealing, or a police officer might go out and deal with calls one after the other, one serious, one not serious. I mean, you just never know what's going to come along in terms of dealing with people. There's no theme other than human nature and the fact that some things need to be resolved. And so chapter 21, we begin with the mystery of unsolved murder. Verse 1, if anyone is found slain, lying in the field in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to possess, and it is not known who killed him, then your elders and your judges shall go out and measure the distance from the slain man to the surrounding cities. And it shall be that the elders of the city nearest to the slain man will take a heifer, which has not been worked and which is not pulled with a yoke. The elders of that city shall bring the heifer down to a valley flowing with water, which is neither plowed nor sown, and they shall break the heifer's neck there in the valley. Then the priests, the sons of Levi, shall come near, for the Lord your God has chosen them to minister to him and to bless in the name of the Lord. By their word, every controversy and every assault shall be settled. And all the elders of that city nearest to the slain man shall wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley. Then they shall answer and say, our hands have not shed this blood, nor have our eyes seen it. Provide atonement, O Lord, for your people Israel, whom you have redeemed, and do not lay innocent blood to the charge of your people. And atonement shall be provided on their behalf for the blood. So you shall put away the guilt of innocent blood from among you when you do what is right in the sight of the Lord. God holds life dear, and every death must be atoned for, even if it can't be accounted for. In other words, they couldn't just ignore the fact that there was a dead body, and it was more than just making inquiry to find out if they could ascertain who had killed this individual. That would be good, but God wanted it to go a step farther, and there had to be this ritual of taking responsibility. Hey, we're the closest city. You know, law enforcement agencies still do this with jurisdiction. It's like, there's an accident. Where is it? Is it on my side of the highway or your side of the highway? Because I'm done writing reports this week. You know, that kind of it. So they had to determine jurisdiction. And then those leaders of that city went through a ritual. And people say, well, what does all that mean? I don't know. I don't know that anybody knows what all the nuances of the ritual mean, except that it was symbolic that, hey, we've looked into this. We've taken it seriously. We're the ones responsible because it's closest to our city. And we can't determine who the guilty party is. And so we're washing our hands of it in the sense that there's we've done all that we can do. And so individual guilt could not be determined, but there was still a corporate responsibility. The land had to be cleansed from the defilement of the murder, and it became the responsibility of the nearest city. And so all the way through all of these things, you're going to see that God just holds human life very dear. And so if there's a death that's unexplained and unaccounted for, it still has to be atoned for, so that you've done everything that you can to deal with it, and then God will go on and bless. Now the next case, the treatment of female prisoners of war. When you go out to war against your enemies, and the Lord your God delivers them into your hand, and you take them captive, and you see among the captives a beautiful woman, and desire her, and would take her for your wife, then you shall bring her home to your house. She shall shave her head and trim her nails. She shall put off the clothes of her captivity, remain in your house, and mourn her father and her mother a full month. After that you may go into her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. It shall be, if you have no delight in her, then you shall set her free. But you certainly shall not sell her for money. You shall not treat her brutally, because you have humbled her. Now, if you were here last week or you're familiar with Deuteronomy, you know that there was a difference between their warfare in Canaan and their warfare in outside areas. Everybody in Canaan was to be killed. All the Hittites, Jebusites, Adicites, all those people were to be killed and wiped out, men, women, children. But when they went to war against enemies outside of the land of Canaan, they were to try and make peace with them. And if the city said, no, we don't want peace, we want war, then they were to kill the men and all, and they could take spoil. And here was a case where maybe they saw somebody and they wanted to be married. Now, this sounds weird, I know, but look at it this way. The enemies of Israel were given a chance to surrender and live. If they refused, they were conquered. And so it was a mercy that the women were kept alive. A greater mercy that a foreign woman could marry into God's chosen nation. And even if things didn't work out and the woman was not married, she was still treated with kindness. It was far better than being killed or the way that other pagan nations dealt with their captives. Now the woman, I believe, did these things voluntarily. She wasn't forced. I mean, sometimes I realize that our brains have been fried by the way that we have grown up, you know, and the images, and you think that this is something weird going on, but basically the idea is that she wasn't forced, it was that she was converted. Then she could be your wife. So if you said, hey, you know, you're beautiful and I'd like to marry you, but you're pagan, and so she'd have to come in and shave her head, cut her nails, you know, which indicated certain pagan rites and stuff, and she'd have to wait this time through and put off different clothes and put on different clothes and basically say that she was converting to Judaism, and then she could become your wife. If she was not, then she was set free because she'd been humbled by the fact that her husband and her city and everything that she knew had been overthrown and killed. And so it was really kind of a good thing that's going on here, not a bad thing. And so this was a law to help female prisoners of war and to treat them carefully and fairly, not the way other nations would treat them, and actually even bring them into Israel in terms of being married. Now the next case, the rights of the firstborn, when the firstborn is not from the wife you love the most. I mean, I really do. I see kind of a judge just going through this, you know, okay, next. My son should inherit, but my husband didn't love me as much as he loved his first wife, even though this is the firstborn son. So what do you say about that? Well, verse 15, if a man has two wives, he's stupid. Oh, no, editorial comment. But if a man has two wives, one loved and the other unloved, and they have borne him children, both the loved and the unloved, and if the firstborn son is of her who is unloved, then it shall be on the day he bequeaths his possessions to his sons that he must not bestow firstborn status on the son of the loved wife in preference to the son of the unloved, the true firstborn. But he shall acknowledge the son of the unloved wife as the firstborn by giving him a double portion of all that he has, for he is the beginning of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his. Now, God never approved of bigamy or multiple wives, but he allowed it. And here we're regulating some of its consequences, such as the right of the firstborn to inherit. And so the husband didn't have the right to just choose whatever son was his preferential son and say, well, I think you're my firstborn from my favorite wife. It didn't work that way. And so they were protecting this right. And the right of the firstborn was a very important right in Israel in terms of getting the double portion and all of those things. God could set it aside in certain supernatural situations, as he did with Jacob and Esau. You remember that whole story. Esau, the firstborn, but he despised his birthright, and Jacob stole it from him. And that becomes an incredibly important analogy in the New Testament in terms of Israel being God's firstborn and chosen people, but despising their status by rejecting Jesus Christ. And then that status then goes to the next born son, the Gentiles. And it becomes an important analysis, especially in Romans chapter 9 and elsewhere. But in general, this is just the legal definition. If you're the firstborn son, doesn't matter who the wife was, you're the firstborn, you get the inheritance. The next case, stubborn and rebellious sons. And so now the judge is moving to the next case. He's got a case of juvenile delinquency. Verse 18, if a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and who, when they have chastened him, will not heed them. Then his father and his mother shall take hold of him and bring him out to the elders of his city, to the gate of his city. And they shall say to the elders of his city, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. So obviously we're dealing with an older son here, not your terrible twos, you know. Then all the men of his city shall stone him to death with stones. So you shall put away the evil from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. People sometimes ask me, what do you do for a child that is too old to spank? And I refer them to these verses. Not really. Notice it was not the parents who stoned him, but the elders. But it wasn't elder abuse. It was the proper punishment for elder abuse. The son had been abusing his parents in his behavior and his stubbornness and his rebellion, abusing his elders. And so they were to take him out to the leaders of the city, make a case. The leaders would diligently inquire, and they had the right to execute this individual. Now, they could not allow delinquency to just rot their culture. So we go through some of these. It's interesting. I'll probably mention it more than once. But there are not too many recorded cases of these things actually happening. There's all these death penalty cases, you know, that we go through. But very few people were actually stoned to death or put to death. And so it seems like it was a deterrent. You know, this was like, you know, with your kid, you might say, hey, I'm going to kick you out. If you don't get it together, I'm kicking you out of the house you're going to live on. Instead, you come and say, look, if you don't get it together, I'm going to take you to the elders of the city. We're going to have it out there. And you knew you were a glutton and a drunkard. And I mean, those guys were sharpening their aim, you know. Probably the elders of the city, when they weren't doing business, they were throwing, hey, what? Watch this. Woo, you know, I'm making that up. But anyway, so what we would glean from this, of course, a couple of things. One, stubborn and rebellious children are a real problem, and it can't be allowed. You need to deal with children at a very young age to bring them under control. Otherwise, you're going to be in trouble. We had an old pediatrician down in San Bernardino. He had been a general practitioner. He retired into pediatrics. Tell you how crazy he was, you know. Most doctors I know retire into Hawaii, and he retired into pediatrics so that frantic mothers could call him in the middle of the night, oh, what do I do? I'm out of diapers, you know, or something like that. I mean, you know, the kind of calls that you make when you're a young mother and you don't know what to do and your husband won't do anything. And so, I won't tell you which one of our children, but it was our son, and he said... He, when little Gene was just a baby getting his first little checkup, you know, and stuff, he was crying and screaming, and Dr. Mason looked at us and he says, if you don't get control of this child's temper at a young age, he's headed for juvenile delinquency. And he was serious. He was really serious. And we took it seriously. And so from a young age, we told Gene we were going to take him to the gates of the city. or something appropriate to our own culture. But anyway, it's very serious that we get our children under control. And it is possible to control children. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. Otherwise, they turn into juvenile delinquents, and they rot the culture. Now, the other thing I wanted to say, compare this law, however, to the story of the prodigal son that we have in the New Testament. Because that was kind of a case like this, where the son wanted his inheritance, and he spent it on riotous living. He went out, and he was a drunk and a gambler and a womanizer. And yet his father, rather than find him and drag him to the elders of the city, he waited patiently for him, praying that God would work in his life. And so in the midst of the justice of the law, there's always room for mercy. So we want to bear that in mind as well. Don't always have to apply the law, but it was often. But as far as stoning, I don't know how many people were. People read this and they think, oh, it must have been a brutal culture. Actually, it was a very orderly culture. Very few people were stoned to death because the fear of being stoned to death kept a lot of people in line. And so I believe that there are things that are deterrents. Now, the next case, dealt with that case, how to treat the bodies of executed criminals. This was a case that maybe the ACLU had brought. If a man had committed a sin deserving of death, and he is put to death, and you hang him on a tree, his body shall not remain overnight on the tree, but you shall surely bury him that day, so that you do not defile the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. For he who is hanged is accursed of God. Now, this is not execution by hanging, but it is having the corpse of the executed person mounted on a tree, hanging from a tree, to expose their corpse after execution to disgrace and the elements. Hanging bodies was a practice in certain heinous cases where it was just a disgusting crime. But even then, it was handled, you may not see this or agree with me, but it was handled reverently and with great care. They said, okay, look, you did it and you have to die. It's heinous. It's perverse, it's gross, we're going to have to kill you. And because it was so bad, we're going to hang your body, to shame people and, in terms of the family and all, we're going to hang your body after you're dead on a tree so that people who pass by understand how serious this stuff is. But it was handled reverently because they would take the body down before nightfall and bury it properly. Defile the land is interesting comment. The picture I get is that you're walking through the land, you see a corpse hanging, and you know right away that some heinous crime has taken place, but it's going to be taken down before sunset, and it communicates to you the seriousness of lawbreaking as you see the consequences, but it also confirms that the hanging was not an act of cruelty or vengeance, but the body of the criminal was carefully removed. And so, it's interesting that we can move through these legal issues with reverence and respect for human life. It's not something that we disrespect. We have these ideas of the Wild West, where they go out and lynch people and just leave their bodies hanging, because that's what they deserve. That's not the idea here. There are some things that deserved very serious punishment, but even then, a society handled it correctly. Chapter 22, we get a little bit more proactive. There's a perspective here that helps you apply the great law, love your neighbor. And so in verse 1, you shall not see your brother's ox or sheep going astray and hide yourself from them. You shall certainly bring them back to your brother. And if your brother is not near you, or if you do not know him, then you shall bring it to your own house, and it shall remain with you until your brother seeks it, then you shall restore it to him. You shall do the same with his donkey, so shall you do with his garment, with any lost thing of your brother's, which he has lost and you have found. You shall do likewise. You must not hide yourself. One thing we would say about this is that it's a sin to do nothing to help. So the idea is that you're out, and all of a sudden here comes old, Dolly the lamb, You know, it's gotten away from your neighbor again. And you quick jump in a ditch, act like you don't see it because you're tired of bringing that thing back. And, you know, you have a responsibility to your neighbor. And by brother here, it doesn't mean your physical brother. It means your neighbor. And just this is just about being neighborly and doing things. This is something that I have to get in because we have a lot of lost things here at the church all the time. Kenny was just telling me we have a whole room full of lost items, Bibles, which is always interesting to me, but there's jackets and different things, and I have to fight the urge to try things on. You know, I think, whoa, possession is 9/10 of the law, you know, and stuff. Thanks for donating that jacket and stuff, and then I realize I can't really wear it because you'll see me with it, you know, and stuff, and so it ruins the whole thing. And so found property was lost by someone, and brotherly love required you care for it until it could be claimed. And so there's a proactive aspect to the society. Some of the other things were kind of negative. What do you do if? What do you do if? Now he's saying, well, now if you see these things happening, take care of them. Verse 4, you shall not see your brother's donkey or ox fall down along the road and hide yourself from them. You shall surely help him lift them up again. If you're the first one on the scene, you can't just drive by thinking that someone else will stop and help. You have to be that first responder and do what you can. We should know that intuitively. There shouldn't have to be a law about it, but there is, and it's in the sense of just realizing that we want to do what's right. Verse 5, a woman shall not wear anything that pertains to a man, nor shall a man put on a woman's garment. For all who do so are an abomination to the Lord your God. Now, some have taken this command to be a proof text against women wearing, for example, pants. Some Christian groups command that women wear only dresses. Yet this command is not against women wearing a garment that in some ways might be common between men and women. It's a command against dressing in a manner which deliberately blurs the line between the sexes. Because see, we always start thinking in terms of our own culture. What we need to remember is that in Old Testament times, men and women wore clothing that was superficially similar. They had long robes and wrapped garments were common for both sexes. In fact, men look like women, if you ask me. If you see these biblical epics, women look like women and men look like women. You know, they all had these robes and overcoats and stuff like that, and it was weird. And so the idea isn't that they didn't wear similar clothing, because they did. Specific types of garments and the way in which they were worn made a clear distinction between the sexes, and this command instructs God's people to respect gender distinction and not begin to blur that. You wouldn't want to get into unisex stuff, you know, that kind of a thing. So we want to be careful applying these things, because we take the Bible out of context by putting it into our own social context, and these people didn't wear pants. You understand that? They didn't have pants. They had long flowing robes. And so for us to say, okay, so women can't wear pants because men wear pants, well, no, men and women, if we were in this culture, men and women do wear pants, but we need to still have a distinction, you know, in the way they're worn and certain things about that. And so it's kind of a gray area, but it's an important one. And sometimes people cross the line and it's difficult. You know, a lot of these things, I've told you before, going through Deuteronomy, you can't have a law about everything. You know, you can say, well, okay, here's this garment idea, and then somebody shows up with a particular garment that you've never thought of before. And you say, okay, what's the deal? Is she dressing like a man? Is he dressing like a woman? Is he just Scottish?
Pastor Gene has been serving in the Central Valley of California at Calvary Hanford since 1985. You can find hundreds more Bible studies by visiting our website at calvaryhanford.com. There you'll find video, audio, and transcripts of sermons just like the one you just heard. You can also find links to get Pastor Gene's books at calvaryhanford.com/books. We hope you'll join us next time on Romancing the Saints as we continue to discover that you are the passion of Jesus.